Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulibi. This week on Culturetopia, Roger Ebert became famous for arguing about movies with Gene Siskel on public television. Now, cancer has left him unable to speak. But Ebert's found a new voice online. NPR's Melissa Block went to his Chicago home to talk about Ebert's new memoir. A look at the new Blu-ray edition of the classic film Citizen Kane, and Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens. It's an exhibition of portraits of black women in New York City. But first,
Borders, the books and music retailer, plans to close the last of its stores today. The Michigan company filed for bankruptcy in February after a disappointing holiday season and years of financial difficulties. Through the spring and summer, executives tried to find a way to save Borders. But in July, they announced nearly 400 stores would be permanently closed. NPR's Jeff Brady visited a Borders in suburban Philadelphia.
Outside the Springfield, Pennsylvania Borders, there's a long yellow going out of business banner hung above the Borders sign. Under that, big posters announcing everything is 90% off. Employee Sneha Abraham will be out of a job soon.
I only got the job because they were going out of business, actually, because they needed extra people to push stuff out.
Abraham says the last few days have been busy, but traffic into the store slowed a bit as the book selection thinned out.
All the fixtures are for sale. A lot of the bookcases have sold already, and people are coming and taking those away.
Nearby, Tiffany Howard is loading the back of her SUV.
And I found a nice bookshelf for my classroom. I'm actually going to use it for a puzzle holder to separate the puzzles in my classroom.
Oh, so it's got, looks like 20 different little compartments there.
Yes, and when I don't need it for a puzzle shelf, I'm going to use it for the kids' mailboxes.
At $10, she says it was a bargain. Michael Clambera left with 7 books. The total bill, $15. He echoes market analysts who say Borders suffered from a combination of problems, including poor management, the economy, and a business that's changing.
I guess with the e-books and everything coming into prominence, it was bound to happen. Was definitely bound to happen, unfortunately, but I still prefer holding a book, but the e-books seem to be taking everything over.
For some customers leaving this Borders, the store closing is a loss. Martha Penny was lugging a bookcase across the parking lot.
I'm sad. Borders is my friend. It's been my friend for as long as it's been around. That's all. It's just sad.
Already inside her car, Patrice Kelly has a bag with 3 books inside that she paid less than $4 for.
Sad day.
Really?
I think so.
Because?
Bookstores are closing.
So where will you go now?
Barnes & Noble, maybe, or Amazon.
As the last Borders closes, rival Barnes & Noble is in better financial condition. Still, its stock price sits at about a third of what it was 4 years ago. Amazon, on the other hand, appears to have the confidence of investors. Its stock was trading for about $35 at the end of 2008. On Friday, it traded for nearly 7 times that, $240 a share. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Philadelphia.
I was born inside the movie of my life. Those words open the new memoir titled Life Itself from the film critic Roger Ebert, who has made movies his life for more than 4 decades now. He and his sparring partner, the late Gene Siskel, had the most famous thumbs on television.
2 very enthusiastic thumbs up for the hilarious comedy A Fish Called Wanda.
Now, at age 69, Roger Ebert depends on that same gesture to help him communicate in daily life. 5 years ago, he lost the ability to speak after multiple cancer surgeries. Roger Ebert leads me slowly through his Chicago townhouse. On the glass door of his office, gold letters spell out The Ebert Company Limited, Fine Film Criticism Since 1967. On the wall, the Pulitzer Prize he won in 1975. He was the first film critic ever to win one. And Ebert points with delight to a manual L.C. Smith & Corona typewriter on a shelf. He scribbles a message in a small spiral notebook.
1966. Bought it for $25. Wow. You just wrote, used it until 1980s when I got a Tandy, your first computer.
Roger Ebert still churns out half a dozen reviews every week, and typing has become his means of speech.
This is Alex, a voice that came built into my computer.
Ebert speaks through Alex a text-to-voice program. He types, Alex speaks the words, and the words flow at a remarkable rate, given that he laboriously hunts and pecks with just two fingers across the keyboard. I sat down to talk with Roger Ebert and his wife, Chaz, and asked him to conjure up his first movie memory. He was 3 years old in Urbana, Illinois. It was the Marx Brothers, A Day at the Races.
The Marx Brothers seemed very strange to me and a little disturbing. Years later, I met Grauco, and he still seemed very strange and a little disturbing.
As Roger Ebert listens to Alex, he'll pantomime for emphasis to make up for what's been taken away. His eyes widen. He might tap his heart to signal, I love you, or thanks. Over the years, he has been treated for salivary gland cancer, then thyroid cancer, then cancer of the jawbone. After surgery, a carotid artery burst, and he barely survived. Multiple reconstructive surgeries followed, but failed. Ebert has no lower jaw now. He can't eat or drink. He's fed through a gastric tube. He breathes through a tracheostomy, which took away his speech. He has a full-time live-in nurse. I came to talk with Roger Ebert about his life as a film critic and his life with illness. Because typing is a long and exhausting process for him, we agreed that I'd send some questions in advance. I wanted to know whether that pugnacious on-screen dynamic with Gene Siskel carried over off-screen, too. Ebert made a fist and punched the air as Alex spoke his words.
We were often angry with one another. At other times, we were very warm. I think we shared a strong sense of morality about films that offended us, either by their content or their general stupidity. What we taught each other was how to defend our choices. Critics are tempted to think of themselves as oracles, and here was this guy getting right in my face and telling me I was wrong.
You write in the book about Gene Siskel's last television appearances with you before he died in 1999. He died of a brain tumor. You write his pain must have been unimaginable, but you didn't talk about it. As close as you had been for all those years, you never talked about his illness. Why was that, do you think?
We had philosophical discussions about life and death over many years, but after he got sick, Gene never, ever discussed his illness, except for the obvious fact that he was sick. The word cancer was never mentioned. I believe he was determined to defeat it, and he was such a competitor that he didn't want to acknowledge any weakness. I was never able to visit him in a hospital. He was intensely private about the situation. That was his decision. I respect it. I think perhaps it influenced me to be very open about my own illness.
Roger Ebert writes in his memoir that when he first lost the ability to eat or drink, he became obsessed by tastes and smells, in particular, a frosty mug of root beer.
Over and over I would fantasize that icy cold root beer. I yearned for the pleasure of it trickling down my throat. I knew that would never happen again.
In the hospital, when we have visitors, he would direct us in playing this game.
This is Roger Ebert's wife, Chaz.
We had to stand in line, and each one of us would have to describe which drink we would take. Not only say A&W root beer, but we would have to describe its properties and describe its effect on us as we were drinking it, describe the bubbles subtly dancing across the top of the liquid. What he doesn't know is the reason he was having those so strongly is because it was a time that they weren't giving him enough nutrition in the hospital, and his body was starving. And his brain turned on its survival mechanism and was forcing him to have these strong, intense memories about food in order to give him an appetite to eat. Mm.
I didn't feel hunger, but my body knew.
Since his cancer and his surgeries, Roger Ebert has found a powerful new voice online. He tweets constantly. He's a prolific blogger with tens of thousands of followers.
Many of his posts are deeply personal about his physical condition. Recently, he wrote about the humiliation of falling out of bed and being unable to get up. At first, he didn't want to disclose that, but he wrote, "This blog has become a venue for my truths." One of those truths was posting a photograph of his disfigured face. He leans toward me, his hands gesturing toward his face for emphasis as he talks about it.
"I was advised not to be photographed looking like this. Well, it's how I look, and there's nothing I can do about it. We spend too much time as a society denying illness. It's a fact of life."
Chaz, did you and Roger talk about that?
Yes, we did talk about it. He listened to people's advice, but he said, "Frankly, I don't give a damn. If someone wants to take a photograph of me looking like this and sell it to the tabloids," and then we came upon the idea, "Let's take our own photograph and put it out there right now." And he sat at the piano and had his photograph taken and said, the headline was from a Martin Scorsese movie, "I'm not a pretty boy anymore." And after that, it was diffused.
Roger Ebert moves very slowly now, and one shoulder is much smaller than the other. His body, as he puts it, was plundered for bone and tissue, as surgeons tried multiple times to reconstruct his face.
"The surgeries caused more damage than the cancer."
Doctors have proposed to you a fourth reconstructive surgery. You're shaking your head no. You have said no. Well, why is that? Why have you said enough?
"I'm going to stop while I'm behind. This is the face I have. I accept it."
And then Roger Ebert was off to the movies. The Toronto Film Festival beckoned. As he wrote on his blog, "The movies, as they always do, will cheer and inspire me. They heal because they take me into the minds of their creators." Fantasy and magic have a grip on the bestseller lists, novels like The Magician King and A Dance with Dragons. The latest book of magic vying for attention is The Night Circus by first-time novelist Aaron Morgenstern. As NPR's Lynn Neary reports, this fascination with the fantastic is both a new trend and an age-old tradition.
Magic has never really gone out of style.
This is the core category of stories that people tell.
Since the beginning of time, says Salon reviewer Laura Miller, people have loved stories about gods and demons, monsters and magicians. But for a couple of hundred years or so, those stories have been competing with the reality-based fiction of the modern novel. Magic was thought to be the stuff of kids' books, and that may be so, says Miller, but don't ask adults who grew up on Harry Potter to give up magic.
Above all, that generation that was raised on Harry Potter has grown up to say, yeah, I may want to read Jane Austen, I may want to read Jonathan Franzen, but I also want to read this intoxicating imaginative narrative as well. I don't want to have to leave that behind just because I'm a grown-up. And really, there's no reason why they should.
Miller, who has always loved fantasy fiction, is delighted to see this new trend. She says readers who might never have indulged in books about the fantastic now feel they have permission to take the plunge.
Obviously, there are many adults who have never had any problem with reading narratives with elements of the fantastic in them. It's more the falling away of the idea that only a realistic narrative is sufficiently serious or sufficiently highbrow or sufficiently adult for a self-respecting adult reader. It's more that once that falls away, then the basic human desire for stories of the marvelous just comes flooding in.
Poised to grab a chunk of this readership is The Night Circus by Aaron Morgenstern. It's the story of a mysterious circus that is the setting for a prolonged life-or-death competition between two young magicians. Before it's all over, the two competitors defy all the rules of the game by falling in love with each other.
The circus came first, and I figured out pretty early on that it wasn't a regular circus and that there were magical things kind of creeping around the edges.
Erin Morgenstern says her own interest in fantasy grew out of her love for books like Alice in Wonderland and later magic realism.
My magic is a sort of real-world magic, and I like that accessibility of like maybe the circus would show up in your own backyard. It makes it seem a little closer.
An artist as well as a writer, Morgenstern's descriptions of the circus are vivid and detailed. It is entirely black and white and made up of a series of tents, each one a fully realized world. No one knows where or when the circus will appear.
The circus arrives without warning. No announcements precede it, no paper notices on downtown posts and billboards, no mentions or advertisements in local newspapers. It is simply there, when yesterday it was not.
The magic in the book is real. The two young contestants, Marco and Celia, have been trained their entire lives for their competition, the rules of which they only barely understand. But if they are in the dark, the people around them are even more so. They think the magic of the circus is trickery, a very sophisticated sleight of hand. No one is quite sure what is real and what is fake.
I liked the idea of having actual magic performed as stage magic. So you could assume that it was just a trick, that something is all smoke and mirrors, but there's that, like, feeling at the back of your mind, what if it's not?
Marco and Celia first meet when she auditions for the circus, and he realizes that she may be more than just a master of illusion.
No one is watching her except Marco as she stands perfectly still on the stage, waiting patiently. And then, very slowly, her gown begins to change. Starting at the neckline and seeping down like ink, the green silk is turning a murky midnight black. Marco gasps. Chandresh and Madame Padva turn at the sound just in time to witness the creeping black fade into snow-bright white at the bottom of the skirt, until all evidence that the gown was evergreen is gone.
As mind-boggling as Marco and Celia's tricks may be, Morgenstern says their magic goes only so far in helping them to shape their own destiny.
The phrase nothing is impossible comes up a lot. I think I wanted to play with that a little bit and have that there were limits to what could be done, like that there's a life and death sort of aspect that they can't fix certain things.
Magic may not be able to fix everything, but in the world of books, it's a force to be reckoned with and enjoyed. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
On this program, we often talk about interesting intersections and conversations that develop around race and ethnicity. We have one of those today. It involves art. Many people think that artists make their art and create from what they know or who they are. So many art lovers are curious about painter Tim Okamura's work. He describes himself as half Japanese, half British. He was born and raised in Canada, but his favorite subjects these days are the African-American women of New York. His new exhibition, Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens, is currently on display at New York's Lion's Weir Gallery. And Tim Okamura joins us now. Welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Michelle. Appreciate it.
How did you become an artist to begin with?
Well, growing up in Canada, there was there wasn't really a lot to do because the winters were long. I used to bother my mother, and she would give me paper and pencils and eventually bought me some finger paints, and that somehow seemed to click. That's how I got on that track, I guess, is at a young age.
Well, you're classically trained, just to give people kind of a sense of your background. You have an MFA from the School of Visual Arts, and some of your paintings have been seen in several films. People who will have seen School of Rock, right. For example, or... may have seen, you know, some of your work in the background. So how did you come upon or choose your current subject, African-American women in New York?
I think it was a pretty natural evolution in that I was very, very much excited by hip-hop. I had actually a hip-hop radio show in Canada, which was the only hip-hop radio show. So I was pretty deeply involved. I had, you know, guests like Will Smith and Ice-T on my show, and I was, you know, really into not only the music but other aspects of the culture, graffiti, and just really got interested, I think, in kind of American urban experiences. When I moved to New York, all of a sudden I was dropping down right in the, you know, in the heart of the birthplace of hip-hop, and people that I was meeting were oftentimes directly involved in the scene, and a lot of those types of people became subjects for me to paint.
Well, how would you describe the work? I would describe it as very kind of realistic, not quite photographic, but...
Right. I really usually just tell people it's like realistic portraiture, figurative work with graffiti elements in the background and urban motifs. It's kind of a blend of a couple of different things.
Well, that sounds about right. Are these all friends of yours?
Yeah, all friends or friends of friends. And Yeah, I try to have some kind of relationship with the people that I paint, because when I'm working on them, you know, for an extended period of time, it's nice to have a connection with that person, I think, and that comes across in the work, I hope.
To that point, though, are people surprised when they look at this work, which has a very, let me just put it this way, there's no ethnic ambiguity here. The subjects you've chosen, they have a very clear, you know, kind of strong African-American cultural look. Their clothing is very contemporary. What's the word? I would say maybe ethnic pride elements that people will recognize right. from the way people sort of choose to attire themselves. A lot of their hair is natural.
Right.
And is anybody ever surprised that it's a guy named Okamura doing this work?
I would say there is quite a bit of surprise quite often. For the most part, though, the reaction is very positive. I just think that the surprise comes from, you know, in life, people want to sort of draw the shortest line between two points. And then when they find out what I look like and who I am and my background, then they sort of have to think a little bit more about, you know, how this connection happened.
Well, you know, on the one hand, it could be a sensitive topic in art. I mean, on the one hand, some people are excited when people from different backgrounds discover each other, right?
Right.
We could put it that way.
Right.
On the other hand, sometimes there's resentment because people say, why is this person from this other background appropriating my life or my
right.
culture to his own use? And I wonder if you've ever gotten that.
I think I have gotten that, not very much at all from my generation and younger. I think, you know, an older generation of art collector seems to be a little bit more aware of that. Sometimes people question it a little bit, but I don't consider myself trying to say I'm an authority on African-American, you know, culture or life per se. I'm really a storyteller, and in my portraits there's a narrative, and I think that the people that I paint, in my opinion, have a very important story that needs to be told.
What do you hope people will draw? Not just from the work itself, but from the fact that you created it. Is there something you think, a larger story than you think people can walk away from?
I really want to pose questions to people through the work. Obviously, I want there to be, you know, an aesthetic response or a visceral response to the work just for how it looks, and hopefully it's well-crafted and well-executed, and that is what is an entry point for people. But at the same time, I think there is a bigger picture issue in terms of content, the models that I've chosen, you know, who I think have been underrepresented in art. And also, you know, I'm this half Japanese guy from Canada doing this work, and I sort of refused to wait for somebody else to do it. You know, I thought that these were important stories to tell, and I really wanted to be the one to tell them.
Tim Okamura's latest exhibition is called Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens. It runs through October 8th at New York's Lion's Weir Gallery, and he was kind enough to join us from NPR's Bureau in New York. Tim Okamura, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Michelle. Really appreciate it.
If you want to see the work for yourself, we will have a couple of photos from the exhibition and more information about the artist on our website. Just go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More.
It's that time again for our movie critic Bob Mondello's latest home viewing recommendation. This week, a new 70th anniversary release of what many call the greatest film of all time, Citizen Kane.
Rosebud. Tragic, demanding, controversial, larger than life, and a mystery even to those who knew him. That's newspaper man Charles Foster Kane, and by many accounts, theater genius Orson Welles, who produced, directed, co-wrote, and starred in Citizen Kane when he was all of 25.
As Charles Foster Kane, who owns 82,364 shares of public transit preferred, you see, I do have a general idea of my holdings. I sympathize with you. Charles Foster Kane is a scoundrel. His paper should be run out of town. A committee should be formed to boycott him. You may, if you can form such a committee, put me down for a contribution of $1,000.
My time's
on the other hand, I am the publisher of the Enquirer.
You may want to watch his performance and the intricate jigsaw puzzle of a film it's in several times, first to revel in its storytelling, then to learn why cineasts love it so much. The Geek Squad explanations are handled in two full-length commentaries, one by director Peter Bogdanovich, the other by critic Roger Ebert, both recorded a decade ago for the 60th anniversary release. Each of them dissects virtually every shot.
You see that little hat
on the table there, and it just kind of jiggled a little bit as they sat down. I want you to play this back on the DVD and look at it again, because, of course, the camera moves straight through the table. How did it do that? Well, the table was built to be in two pieces and to come together after the camera had cleared it.
Think of it as a filmmaking class in a box. The Blu-ray set includes posters and storyboards, a reprint of a 16-page souvenir program from 1941, and even the receipts for three cases of scotch, initialed by O.W., who doubtless wanted them for medicinal purposes while editing. And there's a two-hour documentary recounting the war waged against the film by newspaperman William Randolph Hearst, who considered Citizen Kane a personal slander.
Hearst was absolutely furious about this film and wanted it destroyed, period.
No Hearst newspaper ever published a review. No Hearst newspaper ever published an ad. The orders came from San Simeon.
The great filmmaker Robert Wise, who edited Kane when he was still a kid, thought the film turned out, in retrospect, to be more descriptive of Wells than of Hearst. Outsized, sad, especially at the end, but brilliant. I'm Bob Mandela.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.